Welcome to the Town Hall Review, brought to you by the Salem Media Group. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Ted Cruz takes Wisconsin by double digits.
Tonight is a turning point. It is a rallying cry. It is a call from the hardworking men and women of Wisconsin to the people of America. We have a choice. A real choice.
Could this have slammed the door to a Trump nomination? We'll hear from George Will.
If you get to a second ballot, and I expect we will, I think the Trump forces will begin to melt away.
And in the Middle East, the Islamic State is finally being slowed down by a U.S.-led coalition, but is it too little too late? Senator Tom Cotton weighs in.
President Obama's approach to the Islamic State has been a day late and a dollar short. There's no reason those facilities and those trucks couldn't have been struck a year ago.
We'll also hear from Speaker Paul Ryan on his first foreign trip, a very timely visit to Israel.
In this dangerous, chaotic part of the world, with terrorism all over the world, Israel is one of our most important allies.
Thank you for joining us. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. On Tuesday, the much-heralded Wisconsin primary encouraged many of the forces within the GOP electorate who are convinced the party must nominate someone other than Trump. Ted Cruz shut the Donald down by double digits, raising the possibility of a convention fight and, well, a very colorful RNC convention beginning on July 18th.
The national political terrain began to change 2 weeks ago. In the state of Utah, we won 69% of the vote, a landslide election, winning every single delegate in the state. Then, just 3 days ago in Colorado, two congressional districts voted. Once again, they elected six delegates, and of those six delegates, we won all six.
Many experts feel that it is now pretty close to impossible for Trump to secure the necessary 1,237 delegates to be nominated on a first ballot prior to Cleveland. If that happens, well, then Trump comes up short. What happens then? I spoke with George Will on the new Hugh Hewitt Show from D.C. Let me play for you, George Will. Roger Stone, longtime Donald Trump consigliere, coming off of last night talking on a website about Donald Trump. Here is what he had to say to Steve Molyneux.
I have urged Trump supporters, come to Cleveland. March on Cleveland. Join us in the Forest City. We're going to have protests, demonstrations. We will disclose the hotels and the room numbers of those delegates who are directly involved in the steal. If you're from Pennsylvania, we'll tell you who the culprits are. We urge you to visit their hotel and find them.
What do you think of that, George Will?
Well, I'm not surprised that a man who represents Donald Trump, who has a very weak sense of property rights, as demonstrated by his casual approach to eminent domain, should believe that delegates are his private property. When he talks about delegates being stolen, all he's saying is that under the rules of the convention, now I know rules don't mean much to the Trumpkins, but under the rules of the Republican Party, some delegates go to the convention unbound, others become unbound after the first ballot, others after the second, others after the third. And Mr. Trump's problem at this point is that while he's been flying around, dipping into states, holding rallies, and flying back to Florida, Ted Cruz has been working the system and preparing the relationships with delegates, his delegates, Rubio's delegates, Kasich's delegates, and most of all, Trump delegates, saying if we get to a contested convention and if it goes to a second ballot, here's why you ought to consider Ted Cruz. And here's the real problem for the Trump forces. About 42 or 43% of those who go to this convention will not be going to their first convention. These are Republican regulars, sheriffs, county commissioners, party officials in the various states. And they have one thing in common. They rather like the Republican Party and kind of are inclined to support someone who's been a Republican longer than since last Tuesday. So it seems to me if you get to a second ballot, and I expect we will, I think the Trump forces will begin to melt away.
Let me ask you, George Will, let's assume the Irish bookies this morning are right and the likely contest is Cruz-Clinton in the fall. Do you agree with me that that will be the starkest contrast between two non-incumbents since 1952?
I do. And I think there's another interesting aspect of it. beyond the ideological, there is the personal. Mrs. Clinton is today widely viewed by a majority of Americans as not honest and trustworthy, and I frankly don't know how you fix that. If people don't like your agriculture policy, you change your agriculture policy. But if they decide you're not honest and trustworthy, almost everything you do to fix that problem makes it look worse. But on Cruz's side, he at this point has a kind of likability deficit. So you would have two candidates, neither of whom can run on sort of vast reservoirs of affection. They would have to run on ideas and on ideology and on the stark differences that you're talking about. So in that sense, the fact that neither is scores high in the likability quotient at this point might indicate that we'd have an unusually substantive race.
George, Will, and an unusually important vice presidential selection. The three obvious candidates for a Ted Cruz nomination would be either Marco Rubio or Nikki Haley, or if we were in the middle of a hot, heating up war, a Tom Cotton or a Joni Ernst. What do you think is the best choice if you had to pick tonight?
Well, you'd have to throw into that mix Mr. Kasich himself, because, of course, as you and I'm sure your listeners know, no Republicans ever won the White House without carrying Ohio. You have to carry Ohio and you have to carry Florida. But because there is a gender gap, as they used to say in the Republican Party and approaching women, it really is a more restricted gender gap. It's a Republican weakness with unmarried women.
Correct.
I think Romney carried married women. Nikki Haley is a very promising candidate for two reasons. One thing you don't want in a vice presidential running mate is surprises. You want them to be sure-footed and not make news and not disrupt the narrative of the campaign. She has demonstrated a tremendous sure-footedness going through the traumatic reaction afterwards, after the horrible shooting in Charleston, and also the difficulty of bringing down the Confederate flag from the state capitol grounds in Columbia. And second, she does, as a governor, she is presiding over a state that has been transformed more and more for the better than any state in the union in the last 50 years, and it just continues to boom with Boeing and all the rest down there.
A lot has happened along the way to keep Donald Trump from the Republican nomination. However, despite bullish talk, Mr. Trump would have a tough time defeating a Democrat, be it Clinton or Sanders, in November. My good friend Michael Medved took a look at a New York Times analysis of the electoral map. It's an uphill slog for Donald Trump.
There's a devastating piece of reporting. And I find it tough to argue with it, but I'm sure some of you will want to argue with it. And the headline in the New York Times is "Electoral Map is a Reality Check to Donald Trump's Bid." And what they're actually looking at, and it's two of the numbers guys who work at the Times, Nate Cohn, you may remember he replaced Nate Silver over at the New York Times, and he does their upshot section at the New York Times. And it's usually pretty good. I mean, it's basically just crunching numbers, looking at reality. And that's what they're doing here about the prospect of Donald Trump as the Republican nominee for president. And one of the things that they note is that no one in the history of polling, who is a prospective nominee has been so wildly unpopular as Donald Trump. First of all, he is very, very well known. Usually at this time, I don't know if your name is Michael Dukakis or your name is Bob Dole. There are people, believe it or not, who've never heard of you. Right. But everyone in the country has heard of Donald Trump. He had a very, very successful TV show. He is a public celebrity. He has dominated coverage in this election campaign. And that very small percentage of Americans who didn't know anything about Trump before this campaign now know plenty about him. And that makes it very difficult for him, doesn't it, to reverse the negative impression that people have. How negative? Overall, more than 2-1 negative. Never anything like it. Neil Newhouse, who has been a Republican pollster his entire career, is really one of the most respected people doing his work for years and years and years for conservative candidates, says there is no precedent for this. In the modern polling era, since World War II, right? That's even before Donald Trump was born. There hasn't been a more unpopular potential presidential nominee than Donald Trump. That means more unpopular than Goldwater, who lost 45 states. That means more unpopular than McGovern, who lost 49 states. That means more unpopular than Mondale, who lost 49 states. How bad is it? I'll tell you how bad it is. There's not a single state in which Mr. Trump is winning against Hillary. And against Bernie, it's even worse. He's losing to Bernie Sanders, even worse. So what I would like to ask you is best case scenario. I mean, even assuming that Hillary Clinton campaigns with handcuffs and a striped suit and she's indicted, and best case scenario, assuming just that Hillary Clinton's totally disgraced. How does someone win when such a huge percentage, even of Republicans and independents, let alone Democrats, say, I will never vote for that man? And I just want you to consider, those of you who are true believers in the Trump crusade, just consider for a moment part of what they bring up here in this piece. They say if Donald Trump survives a late revolt by his rivals and other leaders and becomes the party standard bearer in the general election, the electoral map now coming into focus is positively forbidding. It's not just forbidding, it's fatal. It's ugly. It's nightmarish. It's like a horror movie. In recent head-to-head polls with one Democrat, whom Mr. Trump may face in the fall, Hillary Clinton, he trails in every key state. Every one. In Democratic-leading states across the Rust Belt, which Mr. Trump has vowed to return to the Republican column for the first time in 30 years, his deficit is even worse. Mrs. Clinton leads him by double digits in Wisconsin, in Michigan, and in Pennsylvania.
Still to come.
Not a great situation in Syria when we have a butcher, one of the worst mass murderers of the last 25 years, Bashar al-Assad, fighting with the Islamic State.
The march of ISIS may be slowing down, but at what cost? When the Town Hall Review continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Some bittersweet news has surfaced from Libya and Syria concerning the Islamic State. ISIS is being slowed down. Some of their top leaders have been taken out. Supply lines have been breached. And it appears that the Obama administration is finally fully engaging. But why the delay? And what have these past years of feckless world leadership cost? I asked Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, a key member of the Senate Armed Services and Intelligence Committee. Washington Post today, Mike Ryan and Sunderson Rockhobin says, we're about to go big into Libya. The tentative political process comes as the United States moves forward with plans to launch intensified attacks against the Islamic State's Libyan branch, which has up to 8,000 fighters and is the group's strongest affiliate outside of Iraq and Syria. U.S. Africa Command now developing dozens of targets across Libya. What do you make of this, Senator Cotton?
Hugh, it's unfortunate that Libya has reached the point it has, which is a complete safe haven for the Islamic State. If a Republican had undertaken the Libya campaign that President Obama and Hillary Clinton did, it would be front page news every single day. The failures, not just in planning, but the complete absence of planning for anything in the aftermath of the air campaign in 2011. You know, the world would probably be a safer place today if President Obama and Hillary Clinton had done in Libya what they've not done in Syria and done in Libya, or done in Syria what they did in Libya. As it stands, though, we are where we are, and we can't simply let the Islamic State continue to grow and metastasize inside that country. As we've seen in Brussels, Paris, San Bernardino, and other places, they have both the intent and the capability to attack the West, and especially the United States and our citizens. So we have to deny them of that safe haven, and we have to permanently remove their leaders from the battlefield, just as we're trying to do in Iraq and Syria. We can't simply turn our eyes away from Libya.
Well, this Western intervention that the Post is talking about, can it simply be done from the air? It also mentions U.S. Special Operations and their French and British counterparts have established small cells on the ground. But small cells versus 8,000 people plus airstrikes, does that equal success?
Well, the airstrikes are essential, Hugh, and it's not clear that, that any kind of large number of troops are needed. In particular, as you say, France and some other European countries have more core interests and history with Libya. President al-Sisi of Egypt has also shown a willingness to intervene across his border to stop the Islamic State from growing. In the end, there may be some number of personnel on the ground, not just special forces, but intelligence personnel. But again, the Islamic State there actually controls real territory. I mean, it's relatively easily identified, and that territory obviously has to be pummeled.
Now, Syria also in the news. They have retaken the town of Palmyra. They found, of course, the Arch of Triumph, built under the Roman Emperor Severus in 193 in rubble. They found the Temple of Baal al-Shamin in rubble, the Temple of Bel in rubble. But most worrisome, they found the first mass grave, about 40 people, 23 of whom are women and children. I'm not surprised by this. I'm not sure, you know, I should be celebrating the rollback of ISIS, but this is the triumph of Assad.
That's right, Hugh. It's not a great situation in Syria when we have a butcher, one of the worst mass murderers of the last 25 years, Bashar al-Assad, fighting with the Islamic State, an apocalyptic Sunni terrorist group that's dedicated to the United States' destruction. Because in the end, both of those forces are adversaries of the United States and our interest in the region. And the only way the Syria civil war will ever end in a way that's consonant with our interests is for the destruction of the Islamic State and the removal of Bashar al-Assad. And as you say, in Palmyra, of course, it's not surprising that these savages would destroy all these ancient artifacts and sites. I mean, these are people who rape young women and young children and enslave women and crucify Christians and behead Americans. They're not going to have any compunction against a few Roman ruins.
The U.S.-led strikes, though, another Post story, Joby Warrick, who's one of the very best in this business, says that we are finally creating a financial squeeze on the Islamic State. First paragraph, the Islamic State is facing an unprecedented cash crunch in its home territory, U.S. counterterrorism officials say, as months of strikes on oil facilities and financial institutions take a deepening toll on the group's ability to pay its fighters or carry out its operations. For the first time, U.S. officials are seeing clear evidence of the financial strain on the group's leadership as reports surface of clashes among senior commanders over allegations of corruption, mismanagement, and theft. Do you agree with that assessment, Tom Cotton?
Hugh, Joby's on to something there. We have made some gains. I know your listeners will be shocked to hear that there's corruption among Islamic State leaders. our airstrikes have become more aggressive against oil facilities and oil trucks. We've had some success with the Baghdad government turning off salaries into Islamic State-controlled areas, which provided them a tax basis. All of which just goes to show, though, Hugh, that President Obama's approach to the Islamic State has been a day late and a dollar short. There's no reason those facilities and those trucks couldn't have been struck a year ago, a year and a half ago. They're out in plain sight, and everyone knew what they were being used for.
House Speaker Paul Ryan is currently traveling in Israel. He purposefully and wisely, if I say so myself, chose Israel as his first overseas travel destination. The U.S.-Israel relationship could be at a 30-year low. Speaker Ryan explained to me why he went.
I decided that my first trip overseas as Speaker of the House would be to Israel. And why? Because I think we need to show how important our ties and our alliance with Israel is. In this dangerous, chaotic part of the world, with terrorism all over the world, Israel is one of our most important allies. I just left a meeting with Prime Minister Netanyahu. I'm on my way out to an Iron Dome site to review their missile defenses, something that we're in. We cooperate with them on. They've had since I think it's 2005, just from Gaza, about 10,000 missiles and rockets sent into Israel, many of which, most of which, missile defense has been able to interdict, saving, thousands of lives. So I'm here to show our support. I'm here to talk with our allies and to see how we can better cooperate to win this war against radical Islamic terrorism.
Now, there's a fascinating story this morning, Mr. Speaker, about why a British exit from the EU should worry Israel, the so-called Brexit, because Britain, Great Britain, often stops the EU from doing anti-Israeli things. Has that come up yet in your conversations about the future of Europe and the future of Israel?
We've discussed the UN quite a bit and Israel and UN resolutions and any possible proposed. We discussed what we call BDS, which is boycott, divest, and sanction, which is in Europe, and the rise of anti-Semitism in Europe. So, yes, we have. We haven't discussed the Brexit specifically, but there is a rise of anti-Semitism in Europe. Europe has been engaging in this ridiculous and counterproductive BDS shenanigan. We in the Congress have been very forceful about that. By the way, when you try to boycott, divest, or sanction Israel, you're hurting Palestinians as well. So we have discussed that, but not Brexit specifically.
Coming up.
That's why still the American Constitution is bringing tears to my eyes. It is an amazing cultural and civilizational document.
Europe's escalating decline. When the Town Hall Review continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Speaker Ryan, in our last segment, referred to Europe's rising anti-Semitism as a topic of much concern to the nation of Israel. The irony of this fact deepens when one understands that Europe's past attitudes gave rise to the birth of the nation of Israel. Sadly, this is not the only self-destructive position Europe is taking. Its posture towards its terrorist residents is equally baffling. My friend and colleague Dennis Prager recently interviewed Dutch novelist and political columnist Leon de Winter on The Dennis Prager Show.
This piece you wrote for Politico is so important. It is about this instinct in Europe, and certainly it is in America, but we'll talk about Europe for now, this instinct among the European elites to blame the European country's treatment of its Muslim immigrants rather than the terrorists.
Yes. Yes. Cultural relativism. That's what it is about. Being afraid of cherishing your own values, your own culture, your own traditions, doubting everything that has been passed on to us from the past, and because of that also, I mean, that's always the consequence, refusing to make up your mind, refusing to choose and to take a stand and refuse to sacrifice. That's one big complex of phenomena connected to cultural relativism, and that's what we've seen in the last week in Europe.
Right. So let's flesh this out so that it is, in other words, they are more interested in preserving the belief that no culture is greater than any, morally greater than any other, than they are even in assessing who is responsible for terror.
You're completely right. And, of course, it is. We know in reality it's different. There are differences in traditions and in culture and in values. But by refusing to accept this idea, it's also a refusal of defending who you are and defending the amazing legacy of the Jewish Christian tradition. It's all one group of developments. Don't forget, I think at this very moment in Holland, I think 80% of the population is completely secular.
What percent? I'm sorry, because you
80%.
80%.
Completely
Right, exactly. That is what enabled the guys who wrote in Brussels, but they were from all over Europe, but they wrote the Charter of the European Union just a few years ago, and the word Christianity did not appear.
No. No.
But Christianity formed Europe. It's not a matter of whether they believe or not. They're denying history.
Absolutely. That was one of my remarks at the time when they were discussing a European constitution. And one of my criticisms was, in what language are you going to write this constitution? And that's the crazy thing. There's no original language in which this constitution is written. It exists only in translation, because there could have been only one language, or two maybe, Latin or Greek. Then you have an understanding what this continent is about. But of course, it was totally unacceptable. So we have a constitution in 28 languages with tiny differences, but a constitution is also an expression of a culture, of a civilization, of a period in which the right words were found for a certain ambition. That's why still the American Constitution is bringing tears to my eyes. It is an amazing cultural and civilizational document. Try to read the European Constitution. It's about 500 pages. 500 pages of bureaucratic nonsense. It's terrible. It's dead language. And there's still no original. There's Dutch, there's Portuguese, but the original expression of what these European founding fathers wanted to establish doesn't exist. And that's in one image. You get the whole problem of what Europe fails and what it should have had. A real core, a soul. It's not there.
Wow, it's amazing you use that word, because I've been to Europe so many times. I studied in Europe in college. And whenever I go back, I just feel the biggest word that I use to describe it in to Americans is soulless.
Yes. Yes. And it has to do with, of course, it's a long development. It ended up in a welfare state, and this is the cultural price.
Coming up.
What did we do to them? We accepted them. We gave them housing, education, and medical care.
More from Leon DeVinter when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. Not so long ago, Europe was brimming with hope. With the Cold War ending and the subsequent dissolution of the Soviet Union, Europe was a place of hope. In recent years, that sentiment seems to have darkened, however. Radical democratic socialism is choking many EU members economically. And now the mass migration from the Middle East is threatening many of its members with instability and terror, even as Russia grows aggressive. The response to the very real terror threat is deeply concerning. Here's more with Dennis Prager talking to Dutch writer Leon DeVinter.
So let me ask you this. What do you think? Now, I generally don't psychoanalyze people, but I'm willing to allow it here. What, and it may not be a psychoanalytic answer, it may be a philosophic answer, but what do you think is animating the people in Europe who say, oh, it's Belgium's fault for mistreating its immigrants, it's not really the fault of the terrorists? Is it this belief in multiculturalism as deep as a Muslim believes in Islam, or is it something else? What is it?
Yeah, it's of course. I wish I had a clear answer, but at the same time, you feel, and it's in between the lines always. It's in between the words. You feel there's something suicidal in it.
Oh, interesting.
There is civilization heading for the cliff. There's something apocalyptical in it.
Uh-huh.
And it's very hard to put a finger on it and say, yes, there is it. But behaving like this, while the facts are clear, the trends are there, the developments are there, we all see it. And at the same time, although you see it, you don't want to see it. What is going on there? Is it maybe still an echo of the shame of the 20th century to disastrous world wars, the continent where the Shoah, where the Holocaust happened. Is there this deep, and that's what I felt. I mean, at the same time, I admire to a certain degree with Angela Merkel, but with her as well, it seems like she wants to basically end this Germany. It must change. And you're talking about this so-called ghetto, this area called Molenbeek in
mm-hmm,
Brussels.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a bad area when you look at it. I mean, you will be surprised. You will think, hey, that's picturesque. It's not. It's nice. It's old Europe with nice, well kept alleys. And why would people be unhappy? They get free education when they're unemployed. They get a wonderful unemployment money payment. So what the hell is going on? What did we do to them? Of course, that was the question. What did we do to these young men that they start behaving in such a way?
Yes, and as you point out, they are rich compared to what they would be back in Morocco.
Oh, absolutely. I've been in those areas in Morocco. Believe me, that's poverty. It is incomparable to the areas in Belgium or in Holland or also even in France. So something else is going on. It doesn't have to do with what we did to these people, to these migrants, because what did we do to them? We accepted them. We gave them housing, education, and medical care. Should we suffer from that? Is that a bad thing? No, of course not. But still, there is unhappiness. Still, there is anger. But it doesn't have. But it's not connected.
It's not because they're mistreated.
What we did to them.
Yes, they're treated well. In fact, exactly.
Absolutely.
So I am curious. You mentioned Angela Merkel, and of course her call to bring in 800,000, a million. Refugees from Syria and surrounding areas. I wrote an article against it immediately, and I think I was right then, and I still think that is correct. But the bigger question is, why did she do it? My theory, and you totally are free, as you well know. You know me, you know, to say you disagree. I just want to make that clear. But I just want you to react to it. My theory was that the primary animating impulse was to say to the world, look, we Germans are not the same as we were. We are now leading in humanitarian concern.
Yes. That's part of it, of course. She also said it in several talk shows on German TV that the world should think in a positive way about Germany, as if that is her main task, which is, of course, ridiculous. That's not what it is. That's not her concern, basically. Her main thing is to keep Germany safe and prosperous. That should be her motive.
So all right. So if you don't think it's the primary,
well, I wrote about it. I called it the Mother Teresa complex.
Go on.
She's a person without children. There's no offspring. Her father was a pastor. She became also more religious since the death of her father. I mean, I know I'm now sounding like a shrink, but whatever.
I invited that. Go ahead.
It is something also like inviting the children of the world come to me. In her case, although we're talking here about secular Europe, a religious component without the rituals of a church. There's something spiritual to it, and at the same time, it is. By inviting so many people from other culture, it is also a way of accepting the suffering. She has to do penance for what her people did to so many other people in Europe in the previous century. This is, you can only understand, because there's nothing will explain, no political argument will explain her behavior. We have to go into psychology and try to explain it. Also because this was a one-person operation. It was her thing. She shocked her ministers. She shocked her party and the coalition when she started to behave like this.
Coming up, the real-world impact of weed.
Long-time marijuana use might make you a loser.
Michael Medved in the final segment of the Town Hall Review. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Over the past several months, we've looked at several studies about the long-term effects of marijuana use. Let's just say they are not positive, at least not from the standpoint of improving daily lives. Michael Medved looks at one of the largest studies yet, led by the University of California at Davis.
Here is a piece from the Los Angeles Times. And please understand that California is one of those states where there is the highest, of course, not only marijuana use, but there's a huge marijuana industry. People grow marijuana, even though California hasn't legalized weed yet. It probably will at some point in the future. But the headline to this piece is long-time marijuana use might make you a loser. The piece by George Skelton reads, there's a new report out on long-time marijuana use, and it's bad news for habitual stoners. In summary, the more pot you smoke, the more apt you are to be a loser. And it's not so much that losers toke weed. It's that toking a lot of weed over several years turns somebody into a loser. It's not a chicken or egg thing. And here's the stunning thing, is it says that if you use marijuana a lot, and what do they define as a lot? Smoking more than four joints a week. Okay, that's not a lot compared to typical stoners. People who are heavy marijuana users will toke every night, a lot more than four joints a week. And here's a stunner. You want to downward mobility? What does downward mobility mean? It means that you end up earning less money than your parents. You grow up in a middle-class home and you end up on welfare. That's what happens to 52% of middle-class kids who are marijuana users. 52% downward mobility. Among non-users, middle-class kids who have downward mobility, only 14%. In other words, you're four times as likely to slide economically if you use pot more than four times a week. And in terms of getting ahead, climbing the socioeconomic ladder, 33% of non-users move up the socioeconomic ladder, and just 7% of habitual manners users do. Now, let me get to that again. If you're wanting to move up in terms of the quintile of the economic population you live in, you want to earn more than your parents, you want to do better economically, your chance of doing that in America, if you don't use marijuana heavily, is 1 out of 3. Not bad. Your chance, if you do use a lot of marijuana, is 1 out of 13. Okay, why would you use it? I mean, really, what is the point?
Thanks for joining us for the Town Hall Review. Tell a friend and sign up for a podcast of our program at townhallreview.com. And be sure to follow us now on Twitter at Town Hall Review. That's at Town Hall Review. For executive producer Russell Shubin, producers Charlie Richards, Dwayne Patterson, Derek Fowler, and Adam Ramsey, I'm Hugh Hewitt. Join us again next week for another edition of the Town Hall Review, the weekend review program from a perspective you can trust.